BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Just a word of warning. This podcast includes strong language, use of racist terms, and descriptions of violence. Be warned. Over one April weekend 40 years ago, rioters took to the streets. Brixton was burning.
I remember turning the corner, going onto Brixton Road and seeing pandemonium on the street. It was like a war zone and we just roped in.
In the years before the riots in 1981, there were running conflicts between the police and Black Britain. In this episode, the fight goes to the heart of the justice system as innocent people face false allegations in the courts.
Now they had us under their control. They're going to exact revenge violence upon us. All hell broke loose.
We catch up with Winston and Farouk from episode 2. Over the course of 1 year, both men's lives are ripped apart. Winston's freedom is on the line, and Farouk almost loses his life.
I woke up choking. I opened the door to the staircase, and the flames leapt up at me. Then I thought, I've got to get out of here.
I'm Big Nasty, and from BBC Sounds and BBC Radio 5 Live, this is Brixton, Flames on the Frontline. Episode 3, Feel the Heat.
One of the men who I threw on the floor whistled in my ear saying to me, just you wait, we get to the effing station, just you bloody wait. And he was squeezing my throat and I felt my eyes popping out of my head and I could hardly breathe. My tongue was hanging out as if I was being choked to death.
Remember Winston True? We left him face down in the back of a police van.
Given that amount of violence, I knew exactly what was going to happen to me in the police station.
Well, in this episode, things don't get no better for this brother.
He called me, you bastard, and grabbed my head and he smashed my head against the wall. Walked out of the cell swearing and I was in terror. I had no idea what was going to happen.
But before all of that, you need to know some things that are going to be key in Winston's story. We're about to take you back to the morning of his arrest.
Right, okay, what happened to me on the day of my arrest? Right, in the morning, I got up. This is significant. I was unemployed. It's my duty to sign on every Thursday morning at 10:30 at Peckham Labour Exchange, which wasn't far from where I live. Went there, signed on in the morning.
There it is. He signed on at 10:30. Now, do me a favour. Keep that in the back of your mind. By the time the evening came around, he was running late for a Fasimba's meeting. That's the Black Power group he joined.
Top of the Pops started 7:30. And when the Top of the Pops started, I knew I should have left the house already. The last thing I said to Ma, I said, Marie, see you later on. Bye. She had been complaining that I'd spent a lot of time away from home. So I promised her that I'm going to be home early Thursday night, be home before midnight.
It was a promise he needed to keep.
My wife and I spent a whole day together in the house, enjoying ourselves, having fun, playing the children, doing what have you. And then I go to karate 7 in the evening.
But he didn't get a chance to do any of them things there. That's because he's been nicked by plainclothes feds at Oval Tube Station. So he's been attacked, beaten, arrested and falsely accused of a mugging by the police. That brings us back up to date with Winston. We pick up his story inside a police cell at Kennington Police Station. Things aren't looking good.
Two detectives came down, took me upstairs, looked at me and said, they saw me trying to pick a man's pocket on the platform. Saw me trying to pick another man's pocket on the escalator. Then when they approached me, showed me their ID, Bunny shouted, it's fuzz split, and we attacked them.
Winston's not having none of it. But one policeman is determined.
I said, that's a load of rubbish. None of that happened. He did something amazing. He just looked at me, pushed a chair back and gave me 2 slaps in my face. Slap, slap.
He doesn't know it yet, but he's fallen into the hands of a rogue cop called Sergeant Derek Ridgewell, hell-bent on framing Black people for muggings on the tube. With Winston, he's after a signed statement. A confession, and not just for crimes he's pinned on him that day. Next thing, they bring out a big book and start going through it.
I found out later it's an unsolved crimes book.
Winston's feeling the heat.
Okay, Winston, what other jobs have you done? I said, listen, what's wrong with you?
Winston says the accusations keep coming one after another, and so do the punches.
I said, don't you understand? It wasn't us, we weren't there. We were coming in from meetings, nothing to do any of us. Punched again, persuasively. You're not going anywhere till you sign a bloody statement. Called me, you bastard. And grabbed my head and he smashed my head against the wall. Walked out of the cell swearing and I was in terror. I had no idea what was going to happen. It became clear to me that the police were trying to fit me up for things I didn't do. But knowing they were lying wasn't enough. What could I do to counter their lies? What could I do?
And then it hits him. He remembers his Thursday morning routine, the trip to the job centre.
I thought, hang on a minute. I signed on this morning, Thursday morning. Then I knew I had a cast iron alibi. So everything they wanted me to admit to, I said, yes, it was me. When did it? Thursday morning. What time? 10:30. Thursday morning, 10:30. If the police had asked me, were you stealing on the moon? I said, yes, I was on the moon picking pockets at 10:30. Wherever they said I was picking pockets, I said, yes, it was me.
Exhausted, battered and bruised, Winston is desperate for a way out. So he plays the cops at their own game. It's a high stakes move. Winston signs on at the job centre at 10:30 every Thursday. He's hoping that by confessing to a load of crimes at a time he couldn't possibly have been there, the whole case will collapse. He signs the statement and puts his faith into the British justice system.
After I'd confessed, given in as I saw it, I was taken to Camberwell Magistrates Court, four of us, the following morning, put downstairs in the cells, heard voices outside. When I looked through the keyhole, I saw my friend, Bunny, walking along. His eye was swollen grotesquely. To tell the truth, tears came to my eyes and I realised how determined the police were to use violence upon us to get us to confess to their crimes.
But Winston has one thing in his favour, his membership of the Fasimbas. They have money and lawyers on standby for emergencies. They're straight on it. They're his get out of jail card, literally.
We, in the Fasimbas, we had a panel of solicitors. The organisation got a solicitor to come down to the police station. It was a barrister to actually apply for bail for us.
Eventually, after a long night in the cells and a trip to court, Winston makes it home to Marie and his kids.
I left home the Thursday night, a free man. By the Friday morning, I was a villain with two counts of assault of police against me, two counts of attempted theft, and about five counts of theft and robbery from persons unknown. I was in a shock.
Winston spends the next 7 months on bail as he waits for his trial, but he's not alone. The Black Power movement has got his back and they are across everything that's happening in the courts highlighting corruption. To them, Winston and his boys, they are the Oval Four.
So the case of the Oval Four was one of the real big cases in the Black movement at that time because the way they were badly beaten up, I mean, by the police.
Leela Hassan Howe is part of a growing Black Power movement. To them, this isn't a one-off. Not everyone shares their view, but they are convinced that some officers in the Met are out of control.
The police were absolutely on the offensive in the terms of beating up, framing and disrupting the Black community as it was going about its lawful business. So this was something we knew. This police brutality, this wasn't like something out of the ordinary for us at all. Because at that time, there were so many cases. I mean, we were always, there was not a week where we were not involved in some campaign or the other of police malpractice, police framing or police brutality. I would go around and look at the different court cases and just report on them.
She went on to help set up the Race Today Collective, a group that fought for Black rights and empowerment, like the Fasimbas.
In terms of our organisations, and there are many Black Power organisations up and down the country, all producing newspapers.
Getting the word out, having a Black voice is key.
We took the fight for our campaigns against the police off the streets into the courts and had very, very vigorous defences and evidence and cross-questioning of the police. And it would invariably show how much the police were lying and how much they had fabricated. So we were extremely successful in that.
Winston and his friends weren't the only innocent black men to be fitted up for muggings on the underground around this time, though. April 1972, the Waterloo 4. September 1972, the Stockwell 6. April 1973, the Tottenham Court Road 2. All of them, young black men, wrongly accused by the same road cop. But 2 years before Winston's arrest, one landmark trial showed cases of injustice could be challenged.
All Saints Road, Notting Hill. And it was from this street that the demonstrators moved off, because it's in this street that the Mangrove restaurant is situated. Now, yesterday's demonstration and the ensuing fight afterwards have to be seen against a background of relations between immigrants and police, which, in today's happy phrase in the Times, are regarded as always sensitive.
The Mangrove Nine were a group of black activists who were tried for starting a riot in Notting Hill against the feds in 1970. They said it was a peaceful protest. The police said it was a riot.
One of the causes was alleged police harassment of the Mangrove restaurant, favourite haunt of West Indians, and which has been subject to frequent visits by the police. No charges have ever been brought. So why, asked the proprietor, all the visits by the police? Why pick on them?
The trial was a marathon. 55 days. Farouk Dondi made sure he was there.
So I was teaching at the time, and at 3:30 I would go to the Old Bailey and meet the other Black Panther people who were sitting in the public gallery and taking notes on the trial.
Remember Farouk from episode 2, the teacher from India. He looks a bit like a hippie with a full beard. He's a British Black Panther. This episode is also about what happens to him.
I would then take these notes, go back to where the Black Panther movement had the headquarters, and write up these notes for the next day, cyclostyle them and post them all over to different organizations. And on Saturdays, we'd compile the weekly happening for our weekly newspaper called Freedom News. And that was my apprenticeship in the Black Panther movement.
The tabloids are obsessed with the black mugger. But the Black Power papers are saying something different. That innocent people are being stitched up and that the justice system isn't whiter than white. Gus John is a human rights campaigner and a key activist in the Brixton Black Power movements in the 1970s. These days, he's a professor.
I mean, many of the things that I've been talking about were not necessarily reported in mainstream media.
Farouk and Leela are creating a different narrative.
We didn't expect the mainstream media, even the liberal newspapers, to work exactly in our favor or to push the movement forward. That's why we started radical magazines like Freedom News to start it.
They were the ones who were reporting those sorts of events in any depth and detail. But generally speaking, the mainstream national dailies hardly had any reports on those matters that would alert the nation as a whole to the extent to which that was saying something about the state of racism in Britain.
We were able to articulate through the pages of our journal and through our activism the counter-narrative to what was being said about the black population in Britain at that time.
The Mangrove Nine case felt like a game changer. They were all acquitted of the main charge, and the judge said there was clear evidence of racial hatred on both sides. It was the first time racism was officially recognised at the heart of the British state. This was big.
The Mangrove trial and the success of it emboldened black communities to say, yes, we can resist. Yes, it is likely that a magistrate would accept, on the basis of evidence, that the police were acting brutally, illegally, and so on. So more and more groups of black people around the country started to organize themselves to resist police oppression.
There ain't no better place to build a power base than Rowton Road in Brixton. And Farouk is in the heart of it, blood, living in a squat above the Freedom News bookshop.
The Black Panther movement decided that we should have a bookshop. And because Railton Road and Brixton was so special and was one of the homes of the black community, we thought the bookshop should be in Brixton. So we took over a squat. We squatted a building which was empty. It's called 74 Railton Road. It was in bad repair. It had no kitchen, no bathroom. The walls were, well, decrepit. But we thought we could renovate it. We could deal with it.
Brixton, when I moved in the 70s, was a very poor area, very deprived. There were lots of empty houses because the council had put a compulsory purchase order on the area because they intended to build a motorway, which in fact they never did build. But because of that, many people had sold their houses to the council, and these houses then remained empty, and that's why there was the black squatting movement.
Housing in London is a mess, and if you was black, no one wants to rent you a yard, blood. No Irish, no blacks, no dogs. Renting is tough, squatting is easier.
So we just broke down the door and squatted in the shop front. And that's how it was. No police came, nobody came and bothered us. Brixton was a kind of an area that was really left behind.
The front line has some of the worst problems. And in the 70s, that's saying something. Lots of people are out of work and lots of them are black. Brixton is one of the most heavily squatted areas in London. But it's the beating heart of black resistance.
So Brixton became a very, very central place for black activism.
And just so you know, you didn't have to be black to be a Panther.
We're a joint immigrant movement. There was no distinction between blacks and Asians. The slogan was, black is a political colour.
Black power is a force to be reckoned with. But there's an enemy, the National Front. And they just want to keep Britain white.
And as the march sets off down the embankment, a parallel march of anti-National Front demonstrators goose-stepping along the side, all shouting, Sieg Heil.
Extreme right-wing groups want to stop immigration at a time when Britain is opening its doors to new people again. And if you're a racist, it ain't good. The brown people are coming.
Idi Amin had expelled Asians from Uganda.
So in 1972, thousands of Asians are kicked out of Uganda and they are looking for a new home. And like us from the Caribbean, they're British. So they're heading here, joining black and Asian communities which had already settled in the UK.
So there was the Ugandan Asian crisis, the Kenyan Asian crisis, which saw lots of people come to Britain, as was their right, having been former British colonial subjects. Now, that didn't go down very well at all with the British population, and particularly with those neo-fascist and racist organizations.
Who start persecuting people? If you're brown, you're not safe on the street or at home.
At the time, the phenomenon on estates was that one or two Bengali families would live with white working-class families, some of them racist. And they would throw all sorts of crap and fire and whatnot through the letterboxes. They'd abuse the children who came out of the playground. They'd attack old men. It was known as packy bashing on the streets.
Yeah, you heard that, right? Pretty horrendous. And not exactly unusual back then.
That was, you know, violence of the worst sort against people who looked like they were from the Indian subcontinent. Part of the activity of these far-right groups and breakaway individuals from within them was to target black bookshops, which they saw not only as selling books, but as having a particular presence in the black community, especially in terms of helping to build a black liberation movement. Bookshops were targeted repeatedly. Broken windows, firebombs, paint bombs and so on.
And that means bookshops like Freedom News, symbols of black power, are also in the firing line.
These were not just isolated incidents on the part of petty criminals. It was organized internal terrorism by neo-fascist groups whose intention was to destroy black institutions within our communities.
So that puts Farouk, an Indian man living above a black power bookshop, right in the crosshairs. He is a sitting duck. In this podcast, we're recreating the moments which changed the course of people's lives. We've used their own words and created a piece of drama to get you that bit closer to what they have experienced. Nearly a year to the day after Winston is arrested at Oval, Farouk is asleep in a squat above a bookshop. It's 4 a.m.
I remember waking up suddenly. I was choking. It was like somebody had blown smoke on my face because I couldn't breathe. And then I opened my eyes and all I could see was thick smoke. So I crawled, holding my breath. I was thinking, have I leaked the gas? Was the whole house on fire? If so, spread from where? But there were no flames. I opened the door to the staircase and suddenly some flames ripped up at me from the staircase. I banged the door again, but it was quite a fight to push it because the pressure had built up through the fire. I went to the window to try and breathe, to open the window, and took my first breath of fresh air. Then I thought, I've got to get out of here. So there was the low ground floor and the glass front of the shop, of the bookshop was bursting outwards with banging noise. I suppose the fire does that to glass? I didn't know that. But it was exploding outward onto the pavement, and an old lady opposite was shouting, "Oh God, oh God," I shouted back, "forget your bloody God, call the fucking fire brigade." And by this time, the neighbours had all come out because of the fire. It was blazing, and I thought the only way to do it is to jump. I hung myself by my hands to lower my body as fast as I could to shorten the drop. And with my legs dangling below, I pushed against the wall and fell on the pavement, which of course sprained my ankle and burnt my thighs. But I got burns all over. And I wasn't wearing anything except my underpants. One quickly picked up, dragged me across the street. Another guy brought me a big coat and put it on me. And that was all I had. Literally, everything. Everything else was burning. I sat there feeling, well, nothing. Somebody brought me a cup of tea. The fire engine came. The fire chief said, "This is no accident. We're targeted. It was a firebomb." In spite of that, I was never questioned by police. I was sent to hospital where they patched me up and all I was wearing was a coat and underwear. Nothing else. Now, the hospital happens to be across the way where my school was. I felt I should go. I felt I should go to school that morning, do my job and teach. I thought I was thinking straight. But as I walked across the park towards the school wearing nothing but that old coat and underpants, I clearly was not. I went and sat on the steps at about 7 o'clock or 7:30 or so. The school caretaker came and yelled, "What the hell happened to you? Where are your clothes?" And I said, "This is what happened to me." And soon the other teachers came, the head teacher came, and secretaries came. Even some of the pupils came to have a look. All I could say was, my home was burned down. Someone had tried, they actually tried, to kill me. I don't know where else to go. My colleagues pooled their resources, a whip round and such, to buy me trousers, a pair of jeans, shirt, underwear, socks, shoes, or whatever. It was sweet of them, I thought. A few days later, as I was moving to a new squat in the same area, a neighbour of mine told me that on the night of the fire, he saw some guy throwing something from a scooter, and he said he was wearing a helmet and a mask, and he chucked something into our window. At the time, the neighbour didn't notice whether the house had caught fire or whether it took time to catch fire or whatever. He didn't put any of that together until he heard about the fire. The police knew about this. We were not the only black and Asian place to get firebombed. And that was that. My Railton Road adventure on the 15th of March, 1973. And of course, if you were almost killed, you'd remember the date as well. You would never forget.
The bookshop is one of five premises firebombed across South London that night.
All my possessions were gone, right? No books, no records, no clothes, no shoes. Absolutely nothing was left. So it was like I was newborn, right? It was that I, had to start again relating myself to the world.
Attacks with firebombs on five shops owned by Asians in the Wandsworth area of London were blamed yesterday on right-wing extremists. At 4:12 a.m, firebombs were thrown through the window of Ace Suppliers, a DIY shop in Mitcham Road, Tooting, and a newsagent's three doors away. Eight Asians, including four children, escaped with slight injuries. Within an hour, bombs had been thrown at a shop in Upper Tooting Road and shops in Balham High Road and Railton Road, Brixton.
To this day, no one has been caught for firebombing the bookshop.
The police didn't even talk to me. And obviously, somebody who jumped out of a window after a firebomb should have been talked to. But no, they didn't.
Few people were brought to justice for these racist attacks. That provided more room and opportunity for those groups to see themselves as emboldened to do whatever they liked. And so what it suggested was that these are marginalized events perpetrated against marginalized communities, and business could go on as usual while those communities themselves, with or without the active assistance of the police, deal with those matters.
You know what? It's a case of do it yourself. The black organizations had to step up and look out for their people. Because one thing's for sure, no one else will right now. Or that's how it feels if you're Farouk or Winston. So when Winston finally appears in court as part of the Oval Four, it's the Fasimbas who are backing him. They're crowded into the court with his family.
Winston True, 21, of Purley Road, Peckham, was said at the Old Bailey to have been one of a gang of muggers involved in a battle with railway police at the Oval Underground station in March. True and three others have pleaded not guilty to conspiring to commit robberies on trains, to stealing purses and cash from unknown people, and to assaulting the police.
And the press are just loving the mugging angle. Remember though, you know, Winston gave a false confession to Teefin at Thursday at 10:30. It makes a great headline, right?
Thursday is the most dangerous day of the week for women as potential victims of muggers, a jury heard yesterday. The warning came in a statement said to have been made by a man accused of mugging. He's alleged to have told police, "Thursday is the best day for nicking from women because that is when they go shopping." The man, Winston True, 21, of Purley Road, Peckham, was said at the Old Bailey to have been one of a gang of muggers involved in a battle with railway police at the Oval Underground station in March.
His own words, a statement signed in desperation in a police cell, is condemning him. Winston is painted as yet another mugger in a newspaper story, a dangerous black man who needs to be taken off the streets. It's not true, and he's about to see if his plan to outwit the system with his alibi will work.
When it came to my evidence, the prosecution read out that I confessed to five counts of attempted theft. I just had a manager of the Labour Exchange come along and say that at those times I confessed to stealing, I was actually signing on. Well, there's uproar in the court. The judge nearly fell out of the chair. He was shocked. The prosecutor was shocked, even the police are shocked. He said it can't happen.
Incredibly, Winston's quick thinking in the cell works. He proves he can't possibly have done what the police accuse him of, and he's cleared of the charges from the unsolved crime book. There is now a huge gaping hole in the case against him. Winston's hoping the jury will throw out the rest of the charges too. So what do you think happens? You guessed it. He's convicted of the muggings and assaulting police officers at Oval Tube Station. He can't quite beat the system.
Only thing I was found guilty of is what the police said they saw me doing. And it was 7 of them against me. And I was found guilty of that, and the judge was only too happy to give us 2 years in prison each. And that trial was over. We got sent to prison. Now, that's how easy it was to convict black men of things they didn't do in 1970, because the discourse, the idea that black men were thieves, was already deposited in society. And you just had to demonstrate they were thieves. And people readily believed it.
It's now 1973, the end of a terrible year for Winston and Farouk. Two men, two stories, but there are many, many more. Other injustices and other racist attacks. Winston is doing time in Wormwood Scrubs, looking down the barrel of a stretch inside.
You can look back on the past, you can't foretell the future. And the future then looked bleak.
It will take years for him to finally get justice, and for the cop who fitted him up to be stopped. As for Farouk, he throws himself into activism.
And the one thing that was very clear to me, and has become clear over the years, that at the time, the police and the establishment did not care. But I think that when it turned to militancy and said, we're not going to take this anymore, we demand change today rather than tomorrow.
But for some people, that's not enough. In episode 4, we catch up with one of our Brixton boys, Sheldon. And believe me, it gets ugly.
We all came together. We all had one focus point. Kill or be killed.
That's the end of episode 3, but the heat is rising.
Song takes you to a moment in your life.
I knew that I didn't look like everyone else, but because the music was so powerful, it pushed through that.
Songs to Live By is a podcast bringing together black voices from different generations to discuss something we all love, music. We'll be finding out what songs take them back.
Hearing it made me quite emotional. I was lifted into this space of connection.
And motivate them forward.
Absolutely shaped what I wanted to do with my life.
Songs to Live By. Listen on BBC Sounds.